This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give participants in a wide range of social change work a chance to take a longer view as they talk about what they do, how they do it, and why they do it. On this week's show, I will be interviewing John Lucas Buderman, a founding member of the Trans Equality Society of Alberta, or TESA. Though the struggles of trans people have been increasingly visible in recent years, the marginalization faced by many trans people continues to be intense. This includes stigma, stereotypes, exclusion from things as basic as employment and services, often with no legal remedy, and risk of physical violence. It is trans women of color who face the most pronounced risk of physical assault, but being on the receiving end of hostility, threats, and potentially violence is a distressingly real possibility for many other trans and gender nonconforming people as well. Another crucial issue for trans people who follow this route is navigating the complicated and restrictive process which regulates their access to the formal medical and legal transition of their identity in terms of gender and/or sex. Legal barriers and difficulties obtaining identification can have a major impact on trans people's lives and safety. And it was the removal of sex reassignment surgery from the list of procedures covered by the health system in Alberta, surgery that is a prerequisite for many absolutely essential legal hoops that trans people face, that was the final impetus for the founding of TESA in 2009. Though funding has since been restored for the surgery in Alberta, activists with TESA see many issues that remain to be addressed. Buderman talks about his own experience of employment discrimination, his human rights case that has dragged on for 5 years with no end in sight, and his involvement in TESA, the first formal political organization for and by trans people in the province of Alberta. I talked to Buderman by phone from northern Alberta.
So my name is John Lucas Buderman, and I'm a trans-identified Albertan and by extension a trans-identified Canadian. I've been active in the public sphere as an activist for trans rights since 2009. I became interested in being involved in the actual movement for trans rights, initially after being fired explicitly for transitioning, and then subsequently by experiencing loss of funding for trans-related surgeries within my province of Alberta. The organization that I'm with is the Trans Equality Society of Alberta, known as TESA, and TESA started in 2009 in direct response to having trans surgeries delisted by the provincial government. And essentially we decided that there was need for a more formal voice for trans people, as there had been no consultation. We felt that was evidence of need for there to be some degree of formality involved in the trans movement, you know, notwithstanding that there can be many, many different ways of being involved in the movement.
Why don't you tell me a little bit more, if you don't mind talking about it, a little bit more about your experience of transition and then being fired?
So my transition probably would have been in 2007 at some point. I was able to see the single doctor that is authorized in Alberta to approve you for transition. Transitioning for a trans person is a very complex process that is not just, as some detractors might suggest, you just wake up one morning and decide to go have a sex change. Even if you had the funds and other means to do so, that actually is not how the process works at all. It isn't like trying to access body modifications, such as getting your ears pierced. There's a large process involved, including medical professionals. So I finally had the opportunity to see a medical professional. I was diagnosed with gender identity disorder and proceeding on the process of transitioning. And it's a long process. It involves something called a real life experience, which is a minimum of 1 year where you live in your so-called target gender. So if you were like myself, starting from female transitioning to male, you'd be expected to dress typically for a male. You'd be expected to, you know, use a male washroom. You'd be expected to use male pronouns, perhaps have a more masculine name than the one you've been using previously, various things like that that help us fit culturally and socially into a male role, to just sort of try it out, see that it really is for them. Because of course, once you begin, different aspects of the medical transitioning is not really reversible. So, you know, you want to make sure that that isn't somehow an error or not exactly what you should be doing. So it is a long process, and I was at the point where I had been approved to begin my real life experience, but I was a teacher at the time, a substitute teacher. So I was newly qualified as a teacher in Alberta, and like many new graduates, I was out there subbing and covering all kinds of different classes and all kinds of different grades. And I believe I was doing well on all counts until the summer came along. My doctor and I had determined that summer would be a good time to begin the official public side of my transition. I thought, well, it would be reasonable that I end off the year as Mrs., become Mr. when we go back in September. In Alberta, we have a professional association, the Alberta Teachers Association. And the Alberta Teachers Association has had trans teachers before, and they have a professional code of conduct and professional expectations of how teachers are to relate to students, as well as how teachers are expected to be treated. And gender identity is actually listed as protected under both categories. So I expected that as a teacher working for school boards that hires teachers with the ATA. And in our province, that means any public school, and public in this sense is defined as public, separate, and francophone. And separate is usually Catholic, although until recently there was one exception just owing to the quirks of settlement history out here in the West. In any case, those three school boards, the only kinds of teachers they can hire, are also required to be members of the ATA. Just to be very clear that I was working in a public sphere at the time of being fired. So as new teachers to the profession, we're told if you ever have questions, contact the Alberta Teachers Association and maybe we'll give you guidance. So I did that, and that advice was to contact the HR division in any school division that I worked for to let them know what my name was and that I would be returning as Mr. So I did that. And one school board was like, yeah, no problem, we'll update your records. And that was the end of it. And the other school board was kind of like, we'll have to think about how to respond to that. And I kind of naively thought that respond to meant how they would support me in this process and how they would support my colleagues in terms of making that really smooth and easy and something that everybody understood. And the summer came and went without further contact from them. They had said they would contact me over the summer. They didn't. I got my substitute package in the fall, started getting back out in the field. I'd been out in the field for 4 days. And on the fifth day, I got a phone call from the deputy superintendent of the one school district. And he wanted to talk to me about how things were going. And that was the first moment I thought something might not be entirely going so well. So I thought, that's odd, but okay. So he had a lot of questions for me, and I did my best to answer those questions and was asked if I could please don't teach older students at this time. I thought, that's odd. So okay, so I chose different assignments for that period. And on October 7th, 2008, I had been told I would be informed what was happening. I still hadn't heard anything, so I just couldn't take not knowing what was going on. So I called. I was informed that I was no longer an employee of the district, that they did not believe in transitioning, that they had just received advice from the Archbishop of the Edmonton Diocese, that this was not part of the Catholic belief. And the school system was a public district, but the public district there was Catholic. So I remember being in absolute shock with this phone call and saying, well, I vehemently disagree. This is not appropriate. This is not okay. It certainly wasn't what I was expecting to have happen. And I did have the presence of mind to say, so all of this will be in the letter. The deputy superintendent said, letter? What letter? And I tried to be very patient at that moment, but I was very frustrated. And I said as calmly as I could manage, I said, well, it seems to me that if I, a fully qualified teacher, have to go to welfare in order to be able to feed my children, they're going to want to know why a fully qualified teacher is not, in fact, teaching. So he said, oh, okay, you can put it into a letter. And he did. And rather than just affirming that I was no longer working for them, he actually did include the substance of what he told me, which meant that I actually could contact the Alberta Teachers Association and actually have evidence that, yes, in fact, I actually was explicitly fired because I'm transitioning. And it was quite a shock. And that began me becoming very aware of the level of resistance to trans people that is out there, the many types of systemic oppression that exists for trans people, things that I was really quite blind to, and likewise, not just for trans people, was blind to those issues. For all manner of marginalized groups, having grown up with the privilege of, looking white and, being kind of, just another middle-class person, I didn't have those little microaggressions and reminders that there's something different about you. And so I was naive. I felt abandoned. I felt pushed aside as being worthless. The language in the letter had included things like, it was a position of the Catholic Church that person cannot change their gender, period. And then they go on to say a few things. And that phrase has stuck with me to this day, because that was also the first moment I realized that you could so easily be dismissed as a person. Because as I think of it, it's like, well, but I am changing my gender. Ergo, you're suggesting I'm not really a person. That's not cool. when this happened, you know, I wasn't afraid to call my professional association and say, this isn't okay, what's going on, we have to fix this. They were absolutely willing to look at the issue, though not without controversy, because tied into this, as you may guess, is issues around constitutional status of denominational protections under the Constitution. Is a public Catholic school the same as a separate Catholic school? As the average person and the average teacher, I guess I would believe that a public school board is an extension of the government. It is instructing under the provincial curriculum. It is using teachers certificated through the province. All of that body of practice comes from the authority of the province.
So what and steps did the Teachers Association take?
They actually did choose to take up the issue and try to work with the school board to resolve it. That was not successful. In October 2009, we did file a human rights complaint, and we worked together for some time on that issue. They represented me up until a point where they were encouraging me to accept a settlement that I could not in good conscience accept. And the reason I couldn't accept the settlement was quite outside of how valuable the consideration may or may not have been that was being offered. It was contingent upon me being silenced about what had happened. Also, that I would be responsible for pretty much anyone else who might happen to discuss it or mention it. So the Teachers Association and I parted company at that point because they're required to expect that you take their advice. So when I had no representation, the Alberta Human Rights Commission director at that time, the director, decided to reopen the case, took a new look at it and decided to dismiss it without merit. So when I had filed, it had been accepted as with merit, and then a new director came along, and at some point this new director decided it was without merit. And at that point, I had the opportunity to challenge that decision if I did not agree to it, and I didn't agree with it. So I did challenge that decision. I appealed, and you appealed to a third party called the Chief of Commissions and Tribunals, and the Chief of Commissions and Tribunals then assesses the issue and sees whether you should or should not be able to have your case heard. Many, many months later, I did get a decision in the affirmative that, yes, I could in fact have a human rights hearing according to the Chief of Commissions and Tribunals. So subsequent to that, my former employers filed for a judicial review of that decision. So right now, things are bouncing around in the context of a judicial review within the provincial court, and that's in advance of me actually having the human rights hearing for the actual case. Assuming that eventually someone says Jan gets a hearing, assuming that goes through, then I should have a human rights hearing at some point. We're not there yet. This fall will be my fifth anniversary for being fired, and we still actually have not yet gotten to the human rights hearing itself.
Okay, so why don't we change gears and talk about the funding issue that fed into the founding of TESA?
So my understanding that sometime under Premier Lougheed, funding had been put in place for trans people to be able to obtain sex reassignment surgery, also known as gender reassignment surgery, so sometimes known as SRS, sometimes known as GRS. In any case, it was a long time ago, and it wasn't enormous numbers of people every year could have them, but it was available for those who went through the process and kind of waited their turn. In 2009, under Premier Ed Stelmach and Health Minister Ron Leipert, we all woke up one morning to discover the new Alberta budget came down in spring of 2009, and that budget had taken away two things from the Alberta Healthcare Insurance Plan. One of them was chiropractic was no longer covered, and another was that sex change surgeries was no longer covered. For people who don't have sex change surgeries or don't contemplate it, there was a lot of surprise that we'd ever covered it. For others like myself who were partway through a process, there was a lot of chaos. We didn't know what would come of this. And I'd like to kind of back up a little bit more even and just point out that, like in many jurisdictions, for people transitioning, Alberta and Canada for that matter, requires proof of completion of surgery in the form of legal affidavits from your surgeon and other documents. And those have to be presented to places such as Vital Statistics for you to be able to amend your birth certificate to show the correct sex on your birth certificate. That's important because without that foundational document, you can't get things like a passport that shows the correct sex of you as a person. That's further complicated in Canada as of about 2 years ago when the Federal Aeronautics Act was amended to require that your documents match the gender of your ticket and that there's no conflict between your documents. That's a problem because, of course, then legally speaking, technically, trans people could be refused passage on planes within Canada at any time. As far as we know, no one's ever had this actually happen yet, but technically they could be refused. This also ties into things like driver's licenses. Until recently, in Alberta, just to get your driver's license amended, you also had to have completed surgery, provide the affidavits, and so forth. When delisting happened, the Motor Vehicles Branch of Service Alberta actually was fairly rapid in amending their procedures to allow people who had not yet had surgery to be able to apply for a driver's license to be amended to show their correct sex, as in the sex that they're living. Because as you're probably aware, you don't get very far in this day and age without photo ID. And it's a bit of a problem if that stuff doesn't match. And you'd be amazed how many people notice that little letter is not the same as you look. And of course, on your driver's license, you have the additional fun of your personal home address is written on it. So should the person who's noticed that you don't match on all data points not like that and take it really personal, they also now know where to find you. So it's a very uncomfortable situation for people. It doesn't feel very secure or safe. So that was one of the things that when people like myself and many others stepped up and became into the public eye, putting faces and names to who trans people really are, was to help change the narrative about what sex change surgeries was. That, you know, regardless of whether you believe in it or don't believe in it or whatever, none of that really matters. When you live in a day and age where you're only as real as your identity is, and your identity is only obtainable with these very, very complex processes that are all by legislation and ministerial regulation tied to the successful completion of surgery. That's a huge problem. So TESA formed out of that awareness that at a policy level, at a law level, at a ministerial regulation level, there were decisions being made that really affected trans people, but trans people weren't being consulted about what their needs might be. And I certainly do not want to suggest that any of these ministries and that any level of government has ever sat down and deliberately tried to exclude trans people from being full citizens, but in practice, that's actually what happens. Prior to 2009, what was quite typical in media reports that I would see, just as, you know, a person reading the local newspapers, even if a story about a trans person was very positive, the stories would still typically have the person's photo. They would be kind of shadowed. They would usually be using some sort of pseudonym. So even if it was a very otherwise normative sort of story, there would still come this implication that this was something secret. And always very clear that this was done for the protection of this person who could be put at risk by those who might choose to react badly to their presence as a trans person. But that sort of doesn't help in terms of the political issues, because, of course, when any group with power thinks that those others are some mysterious, faceless others, and the othering happens, then it's very easy to dismiss the others because they have no face, they have no voice, they have no identity. And that was a position we were in before TESA formed. There were certainly lots of us around, but there hadn't been an organized voice. So when the delisting happened, a number of us were asked and did choose to speak out publicly in media with our actual faces, our actual names, and we started making it real. And that's why I noticed something interesting happened, which was messages from the government kind of making noise to the effect of, well, we're not picking on trans people because we delisted chiropractic too. And I framed that as being nonsense. I said, well, there's a big difference. If I'm having back problems, I can choose to pay out of pocket to go to a chiropractor, or I can also choose to go out of pocket and go to my local pharmacy and pick up some sort of painkiller or muscle relaxant or something over the counter. Self-funding is not really an option. We're talking about surgeries that I'm told can range from $30,000 to $80,000, so they're not insubstantial. So all of that being tied into all of these ideas of identity, all of these ideas of availability and access under our healthcare system, those are all messages that we needed to speak back to. So all of those are factors in people choosing to organize, people standing up, becoming willing to out themselves at the risk of outing themselves for these very profound, very big issues. And people started connecting, and I remember a meeting that ended up being in Edmonton because people were coming up to Edmonton and protesting on the steps of the legislature, along with other groups that were being impacted by changes to healthcare. And we were able, when we started working together this way, able to really start having those issues framed around that this is a healthcare access issue, an equity issue, it's a citizenship issue. Like, it's a lot of things that isn't obvious by a term such as sex change operation. So we had this enormous meeting after one of these rallies, and people started talking about, well, what did we do? And someone put forward, well, what about a name that kind of indicates the movement, like the Trans Equality Society of Alberta? And that was taken up as being appropriate and agreed that, yeah, that would be great. So that was kind of that genesis, that moment of just a lot of people in the room. And by a lot, I'm going to guess that it was about 60-some people. Many were trans, many were allies, friends, family. They, you know, there was a whole spectrum of people. And again, it was just the people who came. It wasn't like these were all people who necessarily had a background in activism. I certainly didn't. I have to say, again, I've never been afraid of writing a letter to say, there's a wrong that must be addressed. But I never envisioned for a moment that you would ever see me out walking in a protest. So the next step after that big meeting, people people started talking more and more about what such an organization could look like. And eventually, a small group of people came together to sign the correct papers from across the province and get the papers registered with the province to become a formal nonprofit society in the province of Alberta. You know, there's many, many discussions and arguments and passionate opinions and all of the things that happen when you're giving birth to something that's new and never been tried before. And eventually, a small group said, okay, well, let's get it out there, let's get it started, and then we'll see what happens. So once it was registered, then it became a formal organization, and then all of the stuff around organization building starts happening. We recognized early on that we would be having an advocacy role. We actually define ourselves as a political organization. Our intent was to engage in the political sphere, and perhaps in some other areas as well, but we really recognize that at the political sphere, we did not have a voice. So we have that legal structure of being a nonprofit, which means we have annual general meetings. It means we have people volunteer to be elected to or be appointed to our board, that sort of structural stuff that goes on with organizations. And we have met at least monthly. I don't think we've ever missed a monthly meeting since 2009. Occasionally, if there's hectic things going on or something pops up that needs to be addressed, we sometimes have additional meetings. And a wide range of people have shared their talents and skills and knowledge with us, and we've slowly persisted. None of us have funding behind us. None of us have, we don't have an office. We don't have fancy anything. All we have is a will to not fail and a will to persist. We have a mailing address that's located currently in Edmonton. It was previously located in Calgary. We have a mailing address so that someone can mail us stuff should they need to, but we find most people communicate with us online. And from the very beginning, our board has been comprised of people who represent divergent parts of the province. And we have also always chosen to meet alternately in Edmonton and Calgary, which are our two largest cities, to help make it a little easier for people to access us. We do hope that if we exist long enough that we will eventually be able to have strong contact throughout the province. Again, keeping in mind that many trans people who live in smaller communities do not necessarily feel safe about being out. So we also have to be very attentive to needs around confidentiality and security for people who, for many reasons, may not be out.
Tell me about some of the education and outreach work that Tessa has done.
Tessa has been invited occasionally as an organization. More often, members of Tessa's board have been invited, who then also speak about Tessa as well as their own personal experiences, to speak to a number of different groups. We've had a number of opportunities through various university courses where we've been able to come in and talk about not only what transitioning can look like, but also some of those socio-political issues that are not necessarily as explicitly shared by other people within the queer spectrum. We've done a lot of those kinds of presentations. We've made submissions to the federal government regarding trans rights bills that have gone through. So we had things out for C389. Currently, there's another bill called Bill C279 that has just gone through committee stage at the Senate. We were invited by the Canadian Senate to be witnesses for that. And we did submit written testimony regarding why we believe that adding gender identity to the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Criminal Code are, in fact, beneficial things to add. We also hold the position that our Constitution already says that everyone is supposed to be equal, so everyone should already be equal, but it's obvious in practice people don't always understand what the word everyone means. And at this very moment, we don't know whether that legislation will pass in the Senate and therefore receive royal assent or not, but we're hopeful. We have sent letters to various ministries, both provincially and federally, regarding specific types of issues that intersect with trans people, most frequently issues around access to medical care. Last summer, in Alberta, the provincial government actually decided to relist access to trans surgeries, so that hurdle in Alberta has been removed. A number of other related hurdles, such as simply being able to access a family doctor, actually still remains a substantial challenge in our province. So we continue to, again, write letters and talk to a wide variety of organizations, including places like the Alberta College of Physicians and Surgeons. Again, just trying to share and humanize and make people aware of the breadth of the issues faced, that it really isn't just a little minor thing. It becomes a very profound kind of existential crisis.
Did Tessa's work contribute to the relisting?
Tessa was not formally consulted on that process. We sent many letters. By and large, those letters were not responded to. I believe we got our first response from a sitting healthcare minister only earlier in 2013. So I certainly don't want to suggest that we were having, you know, tea and crumpets or something with people in charge of these things. But it was not for lack of sending information, as well as continuing to be willing to speak to other ways of getting information out in the public, such as different types of people within media being willing to be interviewed on a variety of subjects related always back to trans rights and trans issues. And I do want to say honestly, yes, I do think we had an effect on it. Did we have a direct that we were one sitting down directly with government? That did not happen at this stage, no. We do see that there's many opportunities in the future to do that. We see a number of issues, again, remaining both within healthcare, but also things such as vital statistics and being able to amend birth certificates somewhat more easily than we can now. Issues around housing prisoners in the correct facility, both provincially and federally, are issues of concern. I like to think that our ongoing willingness to communicate about these matters and do so as best as possible in a grounded fashion, and by grounded I mean to understand as best we can of what are the rules actually saying? What do we know from experience within the community of how those rules are playing out in trans people's lives? And therefore, what do we see as the actual issues related to those things that need to be addressed? That's the locus of how we'd approach these problems. And I don't know that as a group that Tessa has figured out exactly how to address the issue of outreach to people who don't yet really know they're trans or are starting to think about it but aren't really sure where to turn. You know, when we know someone's trans and they know we're around, I think there's some mutuality in recognizing that we can each help each other achieve our goals. But I remain personally very worried, and I know we've discussed as a board our concerns for how do we reach those people who are new to all this and they just don't know where to turn. Once they show up at a support group, if their community has one, they'll often be able to be connected to some good resources. But what if they don't get there? Or what if that isn't available to them? Those are still some gaps that I think exist, and that perhaps things such as Tessa posting fact sheets and just making some resources available online, maybe those things will help. But I think for me, that also reminds us why we have a call to continue trying to work at that fundamental policy and legal level, that if the statutes are there and in place, that are openly inclusive of all people, hopefully the people on the ground, wherever they might be, will be able to affect a better life with fewer barriers and less resistance to their own transition.
You have been listening to my interview with John Buterman, a founding member of the Trans Equality Society of Alberta, or TESA. To learn more about their work, you can go to their website at tessaonline.org. That's all one word, tessaonline.org. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, or to make suggestions about topics for future shows, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link marked Radio. That's talkingradical.ca. I'm your host, Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Sudbury, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists, Gender and Sexuality, and Resisting the State, both from Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.